Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Politicians pull back the curtain and put on a show. What did we see? 6 hours of policy wonking, a few minutes of posturing, starring the president and a cast of both parties.
We don't care for this bill. I think you know that. The American people don't care for the bill. I think that we've demonstrated in the polling that they don't.
That's Republican Whip Eric Cantor. And how did the audience react? We checked in with our listeners.
I don't know that anyone watching that could have come away thinking that much was accomplished.
I was disappointed in that entire bill that has been worked through the legislative process over the last year. They want it completely thrown out, which really shows no chance of compromise.
So what's the next act? We'll find out on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Friday, February 26th. I'm Lynn Scher in for a few days for Celeste Headlee. And The Takeaway is, there was that summit, John.
Well, you know, the president, and good morning, Lynn. the president says the time for talking about health reform is over, but boy, they did a lot of talking yesterday. Let's get right to the top stories we're following. The president said this near the end of yesterday's televised healthcare summit.
We cannot have another year-long debate about this.
The president told Republicans if they can't compromise, Democrats will move forward with a bill with or without their support. Republican Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee said his party wants a do-over.
Our view, with all respect, is that this is a car that can't be recalled and fixed and that we ought to start over. But we'd like to start over.
Democrats will reportedly wait until next week to see if there's any change in the gridlock.
For a quick recap, we are joined by Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, good morning, Lynn.
Todd, there were a lot of speeches and gimmicks yesterday. Were they, in fact, talking to each other?
Well, they were talking to each other, but only for a minority of the time because there are so many different audiences. They were playing to their political bases. Barack Obama was playing to some of the Democrats in his own party who don't want to follow him on this bill. Republicans were playing to Tea Party people who they want to try to get into the fold for the next election. And they were playing to the cameras, of course, the news media. So sometimes you're playing to the back of the room, sometimes to the wings, sometimes to the balcony. Lots of audiences in that room.
And we'll talk about much more. Stay with us, Todd. We'll be back with you in just a moment.
Another big story, bombers striking at the heart of Afghanistan this morning. It's the sound of suicide bombers triggering a series of explosions and gun battles that killed at least 17 people in Kabul. The target was a row of hotels used by Indian embassy workers. The Taliban is claiming responsibility. Meanwhile, to the south in the city of Marja, Pentagon spokesman Jeff Morrell says NATO-led operations there are trending in a positive direction.
We are transitioning from the clearing phase into the holding phase.
Morrell says crude explosives remain the biggest threat. Here at home, the Veterans Affairs Department is going to bat for soldiers who suffer from what's commonly called Gulf War illness. The VA says now it will reexamine the disability claims of what could be thousands of veterans, the first step toward potentially compensating them nearly two decades after the war ended.
And it was another big day for Team USA at the Olympics with four medals overall. The U.S. took both the gold and silver in the Nordic combined, with Bill DeMong finishing on top.
I don't think either of us really cared who won or got second, and I honestly didn't know what place it was going to be until about the last 2 seconds.
The U.S. women's hockey team lost the gold medal game to Canada. Also, American women figure skaters left the games without a medal. Heavy favorite Kim Yuna of South Korea took gold. Asian and European markets are up. Futures are up. The Dow gets underway at 10,321. The S&P opens at 1,102, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,234.
Coming up a little later in the show, we're going to talk about movies like we do every Friday. With the Oscars a little over a week away, we'll find out which Best Picture nominees are worth seeing. Also, we have trivia. That's later this hour. And all this week in our Frustration Nation series, we've been talking about gridlock in Washington, how to fix it. Today, we're convening a constitutional amendment convention on The Takeaway. What's an amendment to tweak or fix the gridlock in Washington?
You
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Hi, I'm Lynn Scherr, in for Celeste Headlee for a few days on
Good
The Takeaway.
Morning, Lynn.
Good morning,
great
John.
To have you here.
Lovely to be with you. Thank you so much.
Snowy day in New York.
It's a miserable day
yes,
in New
indeed,
York.
Indeed.
But we're nice and cozy inside, and we have great stuff to talk about. For example, they were at it for more than 6 hours yesterday.
What were they doing? It seemed like they were shooting campaign commercials, if you ask me.
Well, in fact, John, the cameras were rolling. It was, as we say, a spirited debate about the president's proposal for health care reform. And, John, at its heart, it was democracy in action.
This is such a complicated issue that it's inevitably going to be contentious. But what I'm hoping to accomplish today is for everybody to focus not just on where we differ, but focus on where we agree. Because there actually is some significant agreement on a host of issues.
But all that talk about bipartisanship resulted in very little compromise, at least publicly. Joining us to review the proceedings is Takeaway's Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick, who followed every lively minute of the day-long forum. And Laurie Robertson is also with us. She's managing editor for FactCheck.org and head of our Truth Squad this morning. Welcome to both of you.
Good morning, Lynn.
Todd, let me start with you. Republicans said they wanted to scratch the bill and start all over again. Here's Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
Every American cares deeply about the quality of their health care and access to health care and cost of health care. They have followed this debate like no other, and they have rendered a judgment about what we have attempted to do so far. The solution to that is to put that on the shelf and to start over.
Todd, talking about starting over doesn't sound like much of a compromise.
No, and it's not going to happen, and if that's what Republicans expect, they know they won't get it from the Democrats. The Democrats have made clear that they're willing to, at least they say they're willing to make some changes to the plan that they have, but that this is the plan they were going with. You know, this whole event, Lynn, as a political event, was extraordinary. Both sides live on television, going at each other. There were some areas of that looked like they could be common agreement, like cracking down on waste and fraud in the medical in the medical system, you know, going after the money that we spend on things that don't really go towards treating people or keeping them well. But in Washington, that stuff is low-hanging fruit. And this event was never going to be a negotiating session. It was never intended to be that. If anyone expected them to shake hands at the end and have a bill, that was never going to happen. But it allowed both sides, I think, to appear engaged in the debate. The president took away all of the objections that he's not willing to negotiate or compromise, or that this whole process has been closed. Here was a process that was live on TV. At the same time, the Republicans take away the accusations that they don't have a plan. They did present a plan. They told the president, here's what we would like to do. We would like to let people buy insurance across state lines. We would like to have meaningful caps on lawsuits against doctors, things as well.
And they did it, Todd, in a very different format than we're used to watching, certainly on television. And by the way, not everyone was always on their best behavior.
Let me just make this point, John, because we're not campaigning anymore. The election's over.
I'm reminded of that every day.
Yes, well, obviously, the two contenders for the presidency, John McCain, President Obama. So other than that kind of thing, Todd, were there, in fact, some real points made?
Sure. I mean, there were real points made on both sides. And I thought the most interesting part of this was, frankly, the posturing, because, again, this was a political event. Democrats kept saying, we're just so close. We agree on so much. And the message there, the subtext is, if you Republicans would just give a little bit, we can get a bill for the American people. The Republicans know what their message is. This bill is unpopular, Mr. President. Scrap it and start over. Those are two political messages playing to two very separate groups of people. If those are the messages going in, they were never going to reach an agreement.
Laurie, let me go over to you now, our fact checker, Laurie Robertson. One of the big issues that came up early was whether the president's proposal would lower premiums. Here's what Republican Senator Lamar Alexander said, followed by the response by President Obama.
It means there'll be about $500 billion of new taxes in it. It means that for millions of Americans, premiums will go up because when people pay those new taxes,
Even without the subsidies, it's estimated by the Congressional Budget Office that the plan we put forward would lower the costs in the individual market for the average person who's just trying to buy health insurance and they're not lucky enough to work for a big company, would lower their costs by between 14% and 20%. So, Lamar, when you mentioned earlier that you said premiums go up, that's just not the case.
Lori Robertson, who's right, who's wrong on this one?
Well, actually, they're both being misleading. And, of course, the truth here is a little bit complicated. But the Congressional Budget Office looked at the Senate bill, which is largely similar to the president's plan, and found that really there would be no significant change in premiums for those who are in group policies, those who get their insurance through their employer. But for those in the individual market, people who buy coverage on their own, they would see an average premium hike of between 10% and 13%. There's a little bit of a but there. The reason that those premiums are going up so much in the individual market is because the benefits are going to get a heck of a lot better. And part of that is the mandate that plans have a certain level of benefits. And the other reason, the CBO said, is because a lot of people in that individual market are going to get subsidies. About 57% of them are going to get subsidies, and that kind of prompts people to get a better plan than they normally would.
So as you say, complicated. No surprise that both sides were a little off on that one. Let me give you another one, Lori. Soon after that, Republican Senator Tom Coburn said this about spending.
The government now directs over 60% of the health care in this country.
Lori Robertson, true or false?
Well, it's not really true. Sorry about that. I can't give you a straight yes or no. Really, the figure's about 47%, but Coburn had asked for a study that adds in a bunch of other stuff that you normally wouldn't include, lost tax revenue due to charitable contributions and lost tax revenue due to deals that employers get for offering coverage. So his figure's inflated.
It is complex, as I say. Little wonder they don't stick to the pure facts. Todd, 10 seconds, wrap it up. What happens next?
Well, the president said at the end of this meeting, I'll give it 6 weeks for you guys to see if you're going to compromise. If not, we're going to ram this home.
Okay, Todd. Todd Zwillick in Washington. Lori Robertson, thanks for your help.
Another deadline. At 15 minutes after the hour, let's take a look at headlines. In Afghanistan, suicide bombers have killed at least 17 people in the heart of Kabul. What you're hearing now is the sound of gunfire in Kabul this morning. Security forces are looking for suspects. Afghan police say they shot and killed two of the attackers. The BBC reports other gunmen are holed up in a hotel surrounded by security forces. In the south, the city of Marja is nearly free of insurgents, but Pentagon spokesman Jeff Morrell says the area is still littered with explosives.
We're still losing troops, and the biggest threat to them remains IED. So we have to be very careful about how we progress into those areas that are not under Afghan and coalition control.
NATO says another service member was killed today by a roadside bomb.
Back home, House leaders have thrown out plans to vote on a major jobs bill today. That's after the Senate passed the bill on Wednesday. Various Democratic factions have objected to the proposed legislation. Meanwhile, the Senate failed to extend programs for laid-off workers yesterday. That jeopardizes unemployment benefits that will expire over the weekend. Democrats could not overcome the objections of a single Kentucky senator who said the $10 billion bill would add to the budget deficit.
It's another big day for Team USA at the Olympics. Four medals overall. The U.S. took both the gold and silver in the Nordic combined, but the U.S. did not win against the Canadian women's hockey team. They lost 2-0. Back home in the Northeast, hundreds of flights have been canceled. Thousands are without power as another slow-moving winter storm settles in on New York, New Jersey, and parts of New England. That's a look at some of the stories we're following this morning. Coming up, we'll get you the latest results from women's hockey and figure skating. We talk with the New York Times Olympics editor Jason Stallman once again with our Olympics takeout coming up in just a few minutes.
What's your take? Leave a comment at thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
News takeouts. Now, you've been watching the Olympics, right, Lynn?
Every single minute.
Do you know the difference between the short program and the long program? In figure skating?
Do you want me to be really nasty and say one of them's longer than the other?
Somebody has to explain this to me. For our first take, how we begin at the Olympics in Vancouver, Canada. Jason Stallman, Olympics editor for our partner, the New York Times. Good morning, Jason.
Good morning, John.
Now, this is our last day of Olympics coverage, but there are events all through the weekend, right?
Absolutely. The climax.
But last night was a pretty big event. The women's figure skating wrapped up with the long program. What's the difference between the long program and the short program again?
It's a little bit longer.
I see. Thank you very much. We've seen your real go-for-broke performances. South Korea's Yoo Na skating flawlessly. Joanne Rochette, best program in her life. I loved Mira Nagasu of the U.S. skating through that nosebleed. How did the long program stack up to the competition in the short program?
Long program was pretty spectacular. A couple days ago, I think when we talked, I likened Kim Yuna's performance in the short program to what we saw 2 years ago in Beijing from Usain Bolt. And tonight really reinforced that, or last night rather. What she's doing in figure skating right now is what Bolt did in sprinting. She's completely turning the sport on its head. She won by a massive margin, more than 23 points. Consider this, if she had competed among the men in the Vancouver Olympics this year, she would have finished ninth.
Wow.
That's absolutely unthinkable in figure skating.
Now, is this because of a stylistic sort of approach, or is it piling on the technical flawlessness?
It's both. It's primarily piling on the technical component. She's doing things that simply no other people can do. But on top of that, she's so artistic that the judges reward her somewhat subjectively for that as well. But she's just superior in every way.
And the U.S. women, you know, don't have much of a chance in this event.
No, the U.S. women were really not strong medal contenders, but they performed well. Mariah Nagasu, a very young, promising skater, she finished fourth just out of the medal contention, so there is hope.
Yesterday we were talking about the Canadian men in hockey beating the Russians as feeling to the Canadians like a gold medal match all by itself, but it was really pretty spectacular with the women last night.
Canadian women look strong. They really outperformed the American women from start to finish. They went 2-0 and take the gold medal. And Canada has a real strong run of female gold medals at this point. It's really their female athletes that are carrying them across the board. Of course, their men in hockey can still win a gold.
I mean, there was a real U.S. women's hockey juggernaut going until the Canadian shutout. Were you surprised by the shutout?
Not terribly surprised. You know, this is a sport like women's softball that it's dominated by two teams. I think there's real concern at this point whether it can last on the Olympic program. It's just not a viable sport worldwide at this point. Canada and the U.S. are the dominant forces, and it just went down to those two.
Although, you know, the U.S. is not being a very good neighbor to the South. I mean, in terms of medal count, where do we stand at this point?
U.S. is having a great Olympics. U.S. officials have to be happy at this point. They're on top of the medal table. You know, they haven't won the overall medal count at a Winter Olympics in 80 years or so. 1932, Lake Placid was the last time. They have 32 total medals right now. Interestingly, what you're going to see happen over the next few days is a discussion about whether you go by total medals or total gold medals.
Right.
U.S. has 8 gold medals, so does Canada right now.
Well, they're even there. All right, Jason Stallman, Olympics editor for our partner, the New York Times, winding up our Olympics coverage in Vancouver. There's still a weekend of competition. Thanks so much, Jason. Wouldn't you love to be on that Canadian women's hockey team? They know how to have fun.
It's bringing out my inner skier watching all this. I want to fly through the air.
What did they do after the game, after they won?
Well, I'm told
reportedly
that they showed up on the ice with their medals around their necks, holding bottles of things they shouldn't have been holding, and cigars.
Nice. All right. Well, they had a good week, eh?
Yeah, sure.
It's Friday, and for our last takeout, we look at the lucky and unlucky in the news. It's in our cooperation with our friends at The Week magazine. It's time for Good Week, Bad Week.
And, John, it was a good week for typos on the Internet.
It's always
specifically
a good week for that.
So listen, if you ever misspelled a website, you know, you put something in, and more often than not, you wind up on a site with a bunch of links on it. Well, some of those links get you to where you want to go. All of them are ads.
Looks like advertisers pay Google something like $500 million per year
for typo-squatting traffic. That is, for their ads to appear when users mistype the addresses of just the very most famous sites.
Typo-squatting. What? Sounds like an Indian tribe, doesn't it? Typo-squatting. That was Harvard professor Ben Edelman. He has filed a suit against Google saying they are profiting unfairly from this practice of typo-squatting. How come? Why is typo-squatting a problem?
Well, it certainly is a problem for the poor advertisers. The advertisers end up paying to get traffic that really ought to be free. And ultimately, of course, consumers pay the advertisers who pay Google. So anything the advertisers are paying, ultimately that comes out of consumers' pockets.
A good week for typos. Good week for Google to figure out how to make $500 million from misspellings. I love that. But a bad week for Cleveland.
Forbes
magazine just came up with their misery index, which measures the awfulness of cities on Forbes magazine's misery index. We caught up with Forbes senior editor Kurt Badenhausen, who broke down how they decided on the most miserable.
We looked at 9 metrics. They included commute times, weather, violent crimes, unemployment, both income and sales taxes, as well as how pro sports teams performed. Cities up at the top were bunched actually pretty closely together the way we scored it. But Cleveland moved up from 4th last year to 1st this year.
Oh, man. Kind of a bad week to be number one. Cleveland didn't take the abuse lightly. The mayor's chief of staff, Ken Silliman, spoke with us yesterday. He says that a miserable city list that also has New York and Philadelphia among the top 10 needs to be reexamined.
This isn't just about Cleveland taking offense to being number one. Rather, what we are saying in Cleveland is, how reliable is this index you've created if our company on the top 10 worst list are some of the most attractive urban areas in the country?
You can nominate Good Week, Bad Week at 8778MyTake or at our website, thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, a story of journalism and justice in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. A cover-up gets uncovered. We're going to talk about it. But right now, let's check in on top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. After hours and hours of healthcare debate yesterday, President Obama says he's not sure the gap between the two parties can be bridged on healthcare reform. Near the end of the conference yesterday, the president told dug-in Republicans Democrats will move forward with their bill with or without them.
Is there enough serious effort that in a month's time or a few weeks' time or 6 weeks' time, we could actually resolve something? And if we can't, then I think we've got to go ahead and make some decisions, and then that's what elections are for.
Republicans want to start the process all over again. The president says no. More gridlock. The Senate did not extend programs for laid-off workers, jeopardizing millions of unemployment benefits scheduled to expire over this weekend. Meanwhile, House leaders scuttled a plan to vote on a jobs bill passed by the Senate this week. There are objections from both sides. They hope to get a vote scheduled next week.
Two co-defendants of a man who admitted to planning a suicide bombing on the New York City subway pleaded not guilty in a Brooklyn court yesterday. They're accused of traveling to Pakistan to train with Al-Qaeda and are high school classmates of Najibullah Zazi, who admitted this week he planned to attack the subways. And here's a test. Who's the top superhero of all time, the Man of Steel or the Dark Knight? According to comic book sales, we have a new champion. Just 3 days after a Superman issue became the first comic book to sell for $1 million, a Batman comic sold yesterday for about $75,000 more.
Kerpow.
It's a rare copy of Detective Comics number 27. You knew that, right?
Oh, yeah.
Where Batman made his debut back in 1939. Back then, the comic sold for 10 cents, and oh, if I'd only kept my comics.
There's an investment.
Let's check the market. Speaking of investment, Asian and European markets are up. Futures are up. The Dow gets underway at 10,321. The S&P opens at 1,102. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,234. And those are some of the news stories we're watching this morning.
So remember when Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, the storm's fury was also something of a smokescreen of chaos. It hid in the lawlessness some of the worst abuses by medical workers, some law enforcement, and others. And this curtain enabled people to elude justice for years, until, at least in one case, yesterday.
Today is a dark and disappointing day for the citizens of New Orleans, especially for the honest and dedicated members of the New Orleans Police Department.
That was New Orleans Police Chief Warren Riley at a news conference yesterday, responding to the decision by former police lieutenant Michael Lohman to plead guilty to federal charges of conspiracy, admitting that he helped cover up for officers who opened fire on unarmed civilians, killing two in the chaos that ensued amid the hurricane. Police shot six unarmed civilians crossing the Danziger Bridge, killing 19-year-old James Brissett and a mentally disabled 40-year-old man, Ronald Madison. The guilty plea is a triumph for the traditional journalists who worked for some non-traditional institutions and stayed on this case despite the odds. And two of them join us. Steve Engenberg is the managing director of ProPublica, a nonprofit investigative newsroom. ProPublica teamed up with the New Orleans Times-Picayune for nearly 2 years to cover the police violence that ensued in the wake of Katrina. And also joining us from New Orleans is Donatus King, president of the NAACP's New Orleans branch. Good morning to both of you. Steve, Donatus?
Good morning.
First of all, Steve, why did ProPublica and the journalists who were responsible for uncovering this stay on the case, and just lead us through the story as best you can?
Well, first of all, it's a little bit more complicated than that. What happened here is that this incident on the Danziger Bridge was a very well-known incident, and in its immediate aftermath, as we've now learned from this plea, there was a pretty massive cover-up. State charges were eventually brought in the city of New Orleans and then later dropped because the prosecutor had botched this. And at that point, the New Orleans Times-Picayune stayed on the case, eventually prompting a lot of additional investigation by the FBI and the federal authorities. Now, what we have done with the Times-Picayune is stayed on the case more broadly of what happened, because this isn't the only case. With the Times-Picayune and Frontline, we have identified a number of instances in which police, after Katrina, shot at civilians, killing them, wounding them, and then engaged in investigations that were very, very questionable. In this case, we now learn the investigation was actually entirely a cover-up.
Right, and Steve Engelberg there is referring to a Times-Picayune and WGBH and ProPublica documentary on the Frontline, a PBS documentary that attempts to figure out what happened in the chaos after Katrina. You know, in some sense, Donatus King, this opens a lot of wounds in the community of New Orleans. Describe your chief concerns about how this is going to, reveal all kinds of revelations as the testimony in the case goes forward.
Hey, well, for one, we're glad in the community that this information is coming out, but it's nothing that's really new. It's being confirmed now from insiders. From the very beginning, there are questions that have been raised, about the Danziger incident and the other incidents that that we just talked about. The NAACP, from the very beginning, met with the Madison family, the others that were involved, has complained to the not only the U.S. attorney, but also the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, trying to get the light shined on these incidents, and finally now we see the fruit of it, that the light is being shined. But as far as where we are right now, there's some relief that this information is coming out, but it raises other questions, and it's our hopes that this investigation will be even broadened. And when I say that, it was mentioned just a second ago about a mistake that was made by the district attorney's office that allowed the charges to be dropped against the shooters. Well, there are some questions right now as to whether or not that was a mistake or whether or not that was part of a conspiracy to have these charges dismissed, because one of the people that were involved in that mistake by the district attorney is the same officer that has now pled guilty to being a part of the conspiracy. This investigation, it should broaden, including going into the criminal court. The judge that presided over this criminal matter, there were many linkages between him, his staff, and the defendants.
know, so it's still a number of unanswered questions.
Right, and a lot of those questions are going to be traumatic for the community, who's going to have to be rehashing all of the events of Katrina. That's Donatus King, president of the NAACP's New Orleans branch. Steve Engelberg, what are the resources of ProPublica, nonprofit investigative newsroom, and the Times-Picayune journalistically that kept this case going, where maybe in other communities it wouldn't have proceeded?
Well, first of all, I mean, the Times-Picayune has had two reporters on this from the very beginning, in addition to which our reporter, A.C. Thompson, first working independently with a grant from the Nation Institute and later as our reporter, has dogged this story for 2.5 years, and now Frontline has joined us with a reporter as well. I just want to point out what Mr. King said, very important here. This story is so wild. Police writing false reports, police supervisors participating in planting guns and cover-ups, that you can now, I think, as a citizen of New Orleans, literally believe anything. And it wouldn't be too far-fetched.
Wow.
This is really an amazing. I urge people to go to ProPublica.org, read the document that charges this gentleman, and decide for yourself. This is like a wild movie in which everything you could imagine about a corrupt police
Indeed.
Force is actually happening.
Well, and it's also the subject of Law and Disorder, the joint production by ProPublica, WGBH, our partner, and the Times-Picayune, a PBS documentary Frontline series that attempts to figure out what happened after Katrina. Thanks to Steve Engelberg, managing editor of ProPublica, and Donatus King, president of the NAACP's New Orleans branch. On The Takeaway, I'm John Huckenberry. We take you now to Kabul, Afghanistan. Militants have attacked hotels and guest houses. 17 people at least are dead, many more injured. The BBC's Martin Patience joins us from Kabul. Martin, this comes after a sort of declaration of victory by NATO forces in Marja, which is quite a ways from Kabul. What's, first of all, the scene in the Afghan capital this morning?
Well, it's quiet now. This attack took place about 8 hours ago at about 6:30 local time, and I heard it as well. There was a huge explosion, and that explosion was most likely to have been caused by a car bomb. That was followed by two smaller blasts, and then there was sporadic gun battles in the city. Now, this attack took place in the heart of Kabul, close to a hotel called the Park Residence Hotel, which is frequented by Western and Indian workers. And as you pointed out, at least 17 people have been killed, including 4 Indians and 1 Italian, and over 30 others have been injured.
Now, Martin Patience, NATO officials are no doubt going to declare that this shows the Taliban's weakness, that they are perhaps defeated in Marja and Helmand province or in Kandahar. They can only respond in Kabul. Do you buy that analysis?
Well, the counter argument is that the Taliban can strike at will in the Afghan capital, Kabul. We've seen that in the last 6 months. We've seen a step up in the number of attacks carried out by the Taliban here in Kabul. And the argument always is that you pressure the insurgency in the south and east of the country. That's where it's at its strongest, in Helmand and Kandahar. But the danger always is that the Taliban will strike elsewhere. And it seems to be clear that the Taliban are sending a clear message that while NATO forces may be attacking them, hitting them in the south and the east of the country, they can still attack in the capital and cause maximum casualties and destabilization here in the Afghan capital, which is supposed to be the most secure part of the country in many ways.
Although, Martin, as you've reported and your colleagues at the BBC have reported, that the government of Hamid Karzai and the reputation of NATO forces in Afghanistan is surprisingly resilient at this point. Is there some sort of built-in barrier to these kinds of bombings hurting the credibility of the Afghan government for a while?
Well, yeah, I think there is. I think many Afghans get angry when their own government can't protect them. I mean, there are security measures in this city. Its security is tight. There are hundreds of Afghan police and army personnel deployed in and around the city to try and prevent these types of attacks. But what we've seen in the last 6 months is that the Taliban and other insurgents increasingly seem to be getting through. And I think there'll be real security concerns, because because psychologically this is a big impact, because if the Afghan government can't secure the capital, how can it secure the rest of the country where the insurgency is seen as being stronger?
And do we have reports that the attackers are apparently still in the city, at least some of them? It hasn't been confirmed that they've all been arrested. And that, again, we should point out that this was targeted in an area where Indian foreign workers are living. Again, 17 at least dead in Kabul's shopping center. A coordinated series of blasts, apparently, by the Taliban. Martin Patience, BBC correspondent in Kabul, thanks so much.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Huckenberry. Celeste Headley's on the road, so Lynn Scherr is joining me for a few days.
Hi, John.
We got some trivia for you on this Movie Friday. Okay, scribble this down. Oscar winner Peter Finch, whose voice we've been featuring all week in our Frustration Nation segment. You know, he's mad as hell and isn't going to take it anymore, right? He holds an Oscar distinction. What is it? That's question number one. Number two, can you name the two actors who won Oscars for playing the same character? And if you can do that, name the character. And three, who has the most statues in any category, and how many? Give us your guesses at our Facebook page, facebook.com/thetakeaway, or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. So, let's get to the leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. As we cruise into the final weekend of the Winter Games in Vancouver, the U.S. is in the lead with medal count, but that's not the story. It's women's ice hockey. The U.S. missed out on gold and took silver when they lost 2-1 to Canada. U.S. forward Monique Lamoureux says it was a tough loss.
It's never fun to lose in a championship game, and for us it doesn't get any bigger than this, so it's pretty disappointing.
Women's figure skating U.S. competitor Mira Nagasu narrowly missed out on a medal. She apologized to the U.S. for falling short in fourth place.
Most 16-year-olds medal at their first Olympics, but I'm sorry that I wasn't able to keep up that U.S. trend, but hopefully I'll be able to make up for it when I get the comeback.
Such a little girl. Today we can look forward to alpine skiing and ladies snowboarding.
And no need to apologize. My
yeah,
goodness.
Really.
From Vancouver to Washington, D.C., during yesterday's healthcare summit, President Obama said, when it comes to covering the uninsured, a compromise with Republicans might not be possible.
With respect to the most contentious issue, I'm not sure we can bridge the gap.
The president said the Democrats are going to move forward to pass the reform bill with or without GOP support. Abroad, Haitian officials now say they want people made homeless by the earthquake to return to their destroyed neighborhoods ahead of the approaching rainy season. Officials will need to demolish buildings and remove mountains of rubble before that can happen. And those are just some of the news stories we're watching this morning.
Let's go out to dinner and see a movie. Let's go out to dinner and see a movie.
Dinner, movie, trivia, Friday's movie day. Rafer Guzman, Takeaway movie contributor and film critic for Newsday, is in the house, or at least on a landline. Good morning, Rafer.
Morning, how are you?
So we're counting down to the Oscars, right? And I'm, you know, barely able to talk, but a little over a week remains until the big night. I've been screaming over all the 10 Best Picture nominees this year. Five animated features, all the regular categories as well. You can't see everything. So we want you to help us sort through what we should see between now and the Oscars and what we can leave behind. First of all...
Right. I guess the most obvious one would be Avatar. That's going to be the ultimate water cooler movie of the year. You don't want to be the guy standing around clutching your coffee cup with nothing to say when everybody else is talking about Avatar. I think that's a must-see.
Ladies and gentlemen... You are not in Kansas anymore. You are on Pandora.
You should see your faces.
We have an indigenous population called the Na'vi. They are very hard to kill.
Man, and just listening to audio does not really take you to where Avatar takes you.
But I see you in blue, John.
3D IMAX, yes. Nice nose there. What else, Rafer?
I think also I'd really like to push people to see The Hurt Locker, which is the other big frontrunner for Best Picture. You know, this thing has only made $12 million so far. I mean, that's,
really?
That's like the equivalent of 20 bucks in Hollywood terms. It still seems to be a typical Iraq war movie that nobody wants to go see.
$12 million? That's Cameron's, like, limo fee. Right.
Yeah, that's less than the production cost, I'm pretty sure. But it's such an intense, such an incredibly well-directed movie. I really think people should get out there and see that film.
You've seen it, right, Lynn?
I have, and I thought it was just astounding. And by the way, when you were doing the news about Afghanistan today, you can't help thinking about that every
Indeed.
Time you hear
right.
the news.
No, it's absolutely iconic, unforgettable. You can't think about war in the same way if you've seen Hurt Locker. Okay, so you think that's a big front runner. What's a less obvious movie that people need to see?
A less obvious movie, one that's kind of going under the radar, I think, is An Education with Carey Mulligan, who's also up for an acting award as well. And that is a really great coming-of-age story. And you know what I liked about that movie was it's not the typical coming-of-age movie where, you know, the teen is this kind of likable hero and some bad things happen and she has to say, oh, well, you know, life dealt me a few hard blows and I'll get over it. She makes a lot of really poor choices and brings a lot of bad things on herself and has to deal with it. And that seemed really realistic to me. And it occurred to me that the last time I saw a coming-of-age movie quite like that was The Graduate, where the hero
wow.
is really making some poor mistakes and has to kind of clean up his mess.
Okay, so he's saying see An Education. Lynn, is it just yeah. because he's a youthful hipster?
I'm sure that he is a youthful hipster, but I would say the reason to see Education in addition is it is the flip side of Up in the Air.
Hmm. Oh, interesting.
And you have to see...
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Up in the Air, we'll talk about it in a moment. The characters weren't really terribly likable, but let's talk about the two movies you said, which is kind of surprising to me, you could actually skip. First, there's the obvious one, The Blind Side.
There is a huge difference between paying for a broken arm and being legally responsible for someone. I mean, a kid we barely know.
That's another thing. We need to find out more about his past.
He won't talk about it. He's like an onion. You have to peel him back a layer at a time.
Not if you use a knife.
So skip The Blind Side?
I think you can skip The Blind Side. I don't quite understand why this is in the running for a Best Picture. I mean... It's amazing and everything that Sandra Bullock has got this, you know, Best Acting nomination. But, I mean, if you go see the movie, it's not as though she's going to knock you out of your seat. I mean, we all know that she's a pretty good actor. She does a good job in the film. But it's really just a very typical, middling movie, inspirational sports drama. Mm. White couple adopts the black teenager. There's just not anything that special about it.
All right, so typical movie and possibly a typical Hollywood backstory, which is why it's in Oscar contention. Precious, though. Skip Precious, really?
You know, here's what I'm saying about Precious. I'm a little on the fence about it. It's most people I talk to, when they say, should I see Precious? It looks so depressing. And I always think, well, it's not really a depressing movie. It does have a message of hope. It does have a message of triumph. It's got some amazing, amazing acting from people you'd never expect. Mariah Carey, for one. Monique, for another, obviously. But I think when all is said and done, it is kind of a typical urban message movie.
Lynn?
No, I'm sorry. I don't buy typical.
You disagree?
I disagree. I like what you said at the top. I agree with you totally that it is uplifting. I agree with you that the acting is out of the park. I don't think it's typical at all. I think it's definitely worth seeing.
All right. A couple of other recommendations that maybe are not so obvious. Rafer says we should see A Single Man. Colin Firth is up for Best Actor. Lynn, you say skip that.
Watching paint dry.
Okay. Rafer says, yes, see White Ribbon. That's up for Best Foreign Film. Why, Rafer?
You know, I thought that was a really, really interesting movie. Michael Haneke, a German director, he is, you know, he's always a little more question than answer, which sometimes leaves me frustrated. But this movie I thought was really effective. I mean, it takes place in a small German town on the eve of World War
Right.
I. All these horrible things start happening.
Right.
It seems like the kids might be responsible. Mm. You're not quite sure. Usually Michael Haneke kind of frustrates me, but I found this one really effectively creepy and thought-provoking.
All right. White Ribbon, and you also recommend The Fantastic Mr. Fox, which is not a kid's movie, and I would recommend that as well. But it's trivia time, Ray. Are you ready?
I think I'm ready.
All right, question number one. Oscar winner Peter Finch, we've been featuring his voice in our Frustration Nation segments all week.
Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad.
All right, so he holds an Oscar distinction. What is it?
First posthumous Oscar winner?
Absolutely, you're right. Number two, okay. Can you name the two actors who won Oscars for playing the same character?
You know, I am not sure about that one. Is one of them Basil Rathbone?
No, absolutely not. Lynn, take it.
I know who it is.
Go, go.
The character is Don Corleone. Can you go from there, Rafer?
The two actors.
Oh, it's...
De Niro and Brando.
Now I'm going to blank on the...
I'm going to make him an offer again with you.
It's De Niro and Brando.
Okay.
Finally, okay, who has the most statues in any category?
I'm going to guess Hepburn. Katharine Hepburn?
No, it's Walt Disney. 26 total, including specials. And if you throw in the seven little statues they gave him in 1938 for Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, it goes up to 33.
Yep.
Thanks, Rafer. Thanks so much.
And if you want more movies, you can read a list of which Oscar-nominated movies to see or skip from Rafer and our producer, Kristen Meinzer. Just stop by thetakeaway.org and click on blog. And while you're there, catch up on anything you missed by getting our podcast. That's at thetakeaway.org.
All this week, our series Frustration Nation, we've been talking about gridlock in Washington and how to fix it. Today, what if the only solution is to convene a constitutional convention? We're doing it right here on The Takeaway. How would you amend the U.S. Constitution to make government work better? Your idea is at 8778-MY-TAKE or post to our site, thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Lynn Scherer, in for Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.